Hi there, I'm Tom Schultz, host of Voices of Montana, an issue-oriented newsmaker radio program. It's heard weekdays on 19 radio stations with 28 signals all across our great treasure state. Thank you for clicking on the podcast. Please subscribe, and we'll do our best to keep you connected. We're also on Facebook and on the web at voicesofmontana.com, where I'd love to hear from you. Please contact me at tom@voicesofmontana.com. CI-128. Pro-abortion amendment, constitutional amendment that was passed this last election season. We talked about it a lot. It's still in my mind. Oh, it was a train wreck of policies, and the language in there is not very good. The story's not over yet, though, with CI-128, again, Montana Constitutional Initiative. Montana Family Foundation has filed a legal challenge to it. And we're going to talk about that today. What is the law behind that? And what are they alleging was violated in this process? You'll be very interested in this one. Derek Aestreicher is going to be with us here. And then a bit later on, this is new. And this is a departure of maybe what you might think is sanity. But Monica Kelsey is the founder of Safe Haven Baby Boxes. And that offers a safe option for mothers who are in crisis and unable to care for their newborn. She's got a story to tell because she was one of those years and years ago. Montana recently installed its first Safe Haven Baby Box. We'll talk about that today on Voices of Montana. Derek Aestreicher now joins us from the Montana Family Foundation, and I'll have him set this up because there's a little bit to go back into to set this up. But the Montana Family Foundation has petitioned the Montana Supreme Court to strike down CI-128. And as we chatted earlier, Derek, good morning to you, sir. How are you doing?
Good morning, Tom. I'm doing really well. Thanks so much for having me on the program.
Well, thanks for coming back on. I appreciate this. You and I have chatted over this issue specifically. I mean, the money that came in from out of state was overwhelming. The language in this was specifically very vague, designed not just to legalize abortion in Montana, which was already legalized according to our Montana Supreme Court, but it was really intended to open up this liberal court, the Montana Supreme Court, and in Montana as well, to open up new avenues for arguments for riskier and riskier treatment when it comes to abortion healthcare. Abortion healthcare, but, gender dysphoria and other kinds of healthcare. So that's sort of the background, you know, my emotions behind it. I just felt that Montana was taken advantage of in a lot of ways. And our Constitution is a pretty good product. And this just trashes it up in my mind. But so I'm glad to see, you know, I thought it was over. I thought we didn't have a legal challenge to this. I know there's the potential to come back and try and rescind this Constitution. That's sort of a long shot. I get that. But I wouldn't mind seeing that in play here as well, because it just doesn't fit there. But talk about this. Go ahead and go. I've set up a little bit here. Launch into it for us here, Derek. And thank you.
Yeah. No. The reality is, if you take a look at the actual text of CI-128, the actual amendment that is proposed to go into our Constitution, it is deceptive and vague, and frankly, it's expansive in terms of abortion rights. You know, currently in Montana, yes, abortion is legal pursuant to a court decision from 1999, but there are limits, and the state can regulate abortion in Montana, although the court regularly strikes down reasonable and sensible regulation. That said, CI-128, if it's enacted, it will open the door to abortion up to the moment of birth. That's a reality. That's what's in the plain text of the amendment. The problem is that voters in Montana didn't actually see the full text of that amendment on the ballot. And that is the crux of our legal challenge. Under Article 14, Section 9 of our Constitution, the Constitution requires that the proposed amendment, in other words, the full text of the amendment, be submitted to the qualified electors of the state for approval or rejection. That didn't happen. If you take a look at your ballot from back in November of 2024, all you would see there is a short little summary statement and a short title of the amendment, you won't actually see the full text of the amendment itself. And that violates the Constitution, plain and simple.
Describe that plain and simple violation.
Yeah, you know, actually, the Montana Supreme Court has evaluated a similar issue. Back in the 1980s, they took a look at Article 14, Section 2. Our challenge, Article 14, Section 9, Subsection 2, excuse me. That particular challenge had to do with a constitutional amendment that was actually passed by even more of a margin than CI 128. It was, you know, mid to high 60s. And the Montana Supreme Court rendered that constitutional amendment null and void because it violated our Article 14, Section 9, Subsection 2. That part of our Constitution requires the Secretary of State to publish the amendment, is what our Constitution says, quote, the amendment, twice in the 2 months leading up to the election. And what the Secretary of State did back in the 80s was they only published the short summary statement. And our Montana Supreme Court said, that isn't good enough. That doesn't strictly adhere to the Constitution. And therefore, we're going to render this constitutional amendment that the voters passed by 60-some-odd percent, we're going to render that null and void. Well, that same rationale applies here to Article 14, Section 9, Subsection 3. Because, again, the Constitution says, quote, the proposed amendment, end quote, has to be submitted to the electors. Well, under that rationale from our Montana Supreme Court, that didn't happen. So CI 128 was never presented in full to the voters.
You know, and part of this too, and Derek Aestreicher with us again, legal counsel, Montana Family Foundation. It's montanafamily.org for more information on this lawsuit. There's also kind of a muddier background as well when you look at how the summary language for this initiative had been challenged and rejected by the Attorney General, who rewrote something, you know, for submission to the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court has to affirm that. They threw that out. And then the Supreme Court essentially wrote its own summary in this regard. It followed a lot of, the folks from the reproductive organization backed by, you know, large liberal money from Planned Parenthood and so forth. You can give those names out here too, but how does that complicate this? Because they've already got, you've got a 1980s case that you think might kind of force their hand on this, but their hand has already written a summary. And right? And so were they not aware of this section at that time?
Well, it appears that nobody has paid attention to this section since about 1976. Mm. After we ratified our new constitution and, you know, in 1972, we gave the people of Montana the right to propose constitutional amendments through initiative. And in 1974, we used that right in Montana for the very first time. And that was a proposed amendment to have biennial legislative sessions. So, you know, the legislature meeting every 2 years. That was actually proposed by a citizen initiative. When that went on the ballot, the full text of that initiative was on the ballot. And the same thing again in CI 7 back in 1976. Since that time, we have not placed the full text of the amendments on our ballot. And there's really no reason as to why we've ignored this part of the Constitution, other than maybe a cost savings measure. But that isn't a sufficient reason to violate our own foundational governing document. And then when you talk about the twisted history of CI 128 itself, yeah, this proposed amendment has been subject to several different lawsuits. The first one was in front of the Montana Supreme Court, where the Attorney General had determined that this was legally insufficient because it was going to amend multiple parts of our Constitution. Mm-hmm. Now, the majority of the court disagreed. Justice Rice dissented and agreed with the Attorney General's position. But nonetheless, the court ruled, no, it doesn't amend multiple parts. Then there was another lawsuit related to the ballot issue statement. And you're right. Actually, the ultimate author of the short little summary statement that did appear on the ballot was the Montana Supreme Court, because they took the language proposed by the Attorney General and they took the language proposed by ACLU of Montana and Planned Parenthood of Montana, and they sided with the abortion lobby and they changed two words, very minor changes. But they were the ultimate authors of this ballot issue statement. And so now before the court is essentially a decision, do we follow the Constitution and what it requires in terms of having the full text of the amendment on the ballot, or do we say that the language that we came up with as a court is sufficient and we don't need to actually give the voters an opportunity to fulfill their right to know exactly what they're voting on? And so that's really an interesting dynamic to this challenge.
Does it affect anything? Does it potentially paint the outcome? Because the Supreme Court had its hand in this summary judgment here as well. And then, you know, you talk about precedents, because if we have not followed the law, then, you know, they might also say, well, that we have not followed the law, so why should we do it here? I mean, I can see this going in a lot of ways outside of just following the Constitution like we ought to. But is right. is there some caveat, because the Supreme Court, I don't know that there is, I guess. I'm just wondering, you know, how the process is going to work out so that we do get a completely fair process on this.
Well, there's a couple good issues there. Number one, our challenge doesn't relate to constitutional amendments from 1978 on. It just relates to CI 128. And that's because there's another part of our Constitution, and forgive me, I don't remember the citation off the top of my head, but I could find it for you, Tom.
But
it basically says you have a statute of limitations for constitutional amendments. And if you haven't brought your challenge within a certain amount of time, then it sticks. Well, you know, certainly our challenge to CI 128 is timely because it's not even a part of our Constitution. Now, the other interesting point there is that every one of our state elected officials, you know, whether that's the executive branch, the legislative branch, or the judiciary, they take an oath to defend the Constitution. Now, currently, the Constitution consists of all the provisions, but importantly for our challenge is Section 9 of Article 14. That's part of our Constitution and part of what elected officials are sworn to defend. Now, when it comes to CI 128, that's not a part of our Constitution. There's no duty to defend that provision. But there is a duty to defend the provision that requires the full text of the amendment to be on the ballot. And so I think that's an interesting dynamic as well. And, you know, another thing I'll mention, Tom, is the Attorney General's office on behalf of the state filed a notice with the court that agreed that our petition raises important issues, statewide important issues, and provided notice to the court that the AG's office thinks that substantial briefing on this topic would benefit the court. Now, the court has taken no action yet, but we're hoping that they order briefing from the state and from any, you know, potential intervening parties so that we can fully evaluate this issue and ensure that this is constitutionally sufficient. If we're going to put it in our Constitution, it has to strictly adhere with the Constitution itself.
So that's thank you for that, Derek. Derek Astreicher with us. I know I got to take a break. I want to kind of ask this one because it's a unique position, as you bring up here. As a third party, you have sued the state of Montana. Well, the state has would have to defend that lawsuit. But this brief from the Attorney General, what does that do to the court proceedings? Because they're saying we essentially agree with the plaintiffs in this.
Well, I wouldn't take it that far. They have agreed that this challenge raises important issues that should be evaluated by the court.
Okay.
I can't say that they agree with my position. I don't think that would be proper to say.
Okay.
Although it would be welcome if they did. But they've agreed that there are important issues raised that should be addressed by the court. In other words, they're saying, hey, court, you should actually take this case because, you know, this is a petition for original jurisdiction. Normally, our our Supreme Court sits as an appellate court, but under extremely important circumstances like the ones here, where we have issues of statewide importance and there's urgency because this becomes a part of our Constitution on July 1st. So the clock is ticking. Under those types of circumstances, the court can take up what they call original jurisdiction and actually hear a matter that isn't on appeal. It's just a direct petition to the court.
Understood.
So the AG's office has agreed that this is important enough that the court should take a look, and has suggested to the court that, hey, you know, briefing from the parties might benefit the court and the public on this issue.
They have not, as you noted, taken any action on it, but it's still relatively new or young in the process here. I think it's been sitting there for like about a week. Yeah. Talking about CI 128, it had passed in this last election, but doesn't take effect until the 1st of July. There is now a lawsuit filed, a petition for original jurisdiction on this, filed by the Montana Family Foundation, challenging the constitutionality of CI 128. Derek A. Stryker is with us, legal counsel, MontanaFamily.org, for more information on that. Derek, I really appreciate how you approach this. You know, as far as doing an interview, you mix in the right kind of legal language, but you make it simple for us to understand. So I appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Tom. I'm a simple man.
That's good. There's a lot of joy in that. There's another aspect. There's several aspects of this that we need to talk about here. But this, let's go back to the court challenge itself. I think you established pretty well that the Constitution requires the proposed amendment, not merely a summary explanation on the ballot. And then there's a reason why that's important here, because your second point is it's a violation of equal protection rights for same-day voter registrants.
Yeah, that's right, Tom. So not only did the submission of CI 128 to the voters violate every voter's rights under our Montana Constitution, but we also have the Equal Protection Clause of the Montana Constitution and the U.S. Constitution. And that comes into play because, you know, we've been treating our same day or election day voter registrants differently than all the other qualified electors of the state. So if you think about it, there are opportunities to look at the full text of the amendment prior to election day. So that would be if you are a petition signer when petitions are circulated, you know, about 6 months or more before the election. If you are a registered elector 45 days in advance of the election, the Secretary of State's office directs our county clerks to send out the voter information pamphlet to voters. So you're going to see the full text there. And then there's the publication requirements that we talked about under Article 14, where the Secretary of State publishes that full text in the newspapers. But if you're a same day or election day voter registrant, there's no guarantee that you're going to see that publication of the full text of amendment. And the Supreme Court has rejected that idea that, you know, quote unquote, widespread availability suffices to satisfy our Constitution. Mm-hmm. If you're an election day registrant, you're also not a petition signer because you're not a qualified elector at the time that petitions are circulated. And you don't get the voter information pamphlet because you aren't registered 45 days in advance of the election. And so a couple of our petitioners or challengers in this case were, in fact, election day registrants who were given a ballot on election day and never had an opportunity to evaluate the full text of the amendment, unlike electors that were registered in advance of the election. And so our Montana Supreme Court actually has evaluated this in other cases and said that, no, we can't treat some, you know, one person's vote different than another. And that's essentially what we've done here, is we've allowed qualified electors who are registered in advance of the election to have a more a better opportunity to be more informed about what they're actually voting on than those folks who register on election day. And that particular issue was not a part of the legal landscape back in the 80s. When the Waltermeyer decisions came down, because we didn't have election day registration at that time. But we do now, and since 2006, we have had that, and we have a duty not to treat those voters any differently than the other qualified electors of this state. But that's exactly what took place here with CI 128 as well. So there's a couple different constitutional violations.
We don't have time for it right now, but I did it almost weekly during the election season, reminding people of the difference, you know, reading the actual amendment language. And, you know, it sometimes it takes a legal mind to spot those things. And I don't have a legal mind, but I saw danger in there that maybe a lot of other people. Why does that have to take, you know, like you would say, a law degree to understand the Constitution? I think there's a large difference in this case between the summary and then also the actual language here. And the Supreme Court
There's a vast difference between the summary. And, you know, that's a part of the reason why we have the requirement to have the full text of amendments on the ballot, so that voters have an opportunity to evaluate the language for themselves. It's one thing to get a summary from the Attorney General or from the proponents of a constitutional amendment, but the fact of the matter is you shouldn't need a law degree to read the actual text of an amendment and figure out what it says. But that's what was required for CI-128, because it's so confusingly worded.
Purposely deceptive.
I would characterize it as such, yes.
Yeah. All right, Derek, we got like 2.5 minutes here, and I want to move on to this because, and thank you for this, we'll follow this. I know it'll move kind of fast because, you know, it's going to, July 1st is when it's going to, you know, enter our Constitution. The Supreme Court has ruled recently on a case from Tennessee about a law to protect kids from transgender procedures, and they've said that the states do have that right. I know that's probably going to be a ruling that many are glad to see, family groups, I should say. How will that affect Montana?
You know, I think it's a positive for not only Montana, but across the nation. You know, there's 25 other states that have passed what we call help not harm laws. And these are laws that empower states to act in the protection of children. You know, we have these radical experimental procedures that are being performed on children all around the country, trying to treat their gender dysphoria with irreversible consequences. You know, this is cross-sex hormones, puberty blockers, and then surgical intervention that cannot be reversed. And these kids are being damaged for life, and this industry is creating lifelong patients. But the U.S. Supreme Court said, look, this is an equal protection challenge. We have to decide whether or not the state is required to meet a heightened level of scrutiny or whether they just have to have a rational basis. And they said they only need a rational basis here. They only need a rational basis related to the objectives of protecting children. And so this is juxtaposed with the Montana Supreme Court's decision from about a year ago on Senate Bill 99, where the Montana Supreme Court, in my opinion, got it wrong based on the decision yesterday in Scrimeti. They said, oh, yeah, we actually need to apply this heightened level of scrutiny. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court disagrees. You only need a rational basis to act in the interests of protecting children from these radical experiments.
Will there be a case? I've got 30 seconds. Will there be a case that challenges this upcoming, do you think, in Montana?
Yeah, you know, the Senate Bill 99 case is still working its way through the process. I fully anticipate an appeal by the state on the merits of the law. And based on the Scrimeti case, I think there's a chance that the Montana Supreme Court would reverse their previous decision on the injunctive relief and say, you know, the state does have a rational basis in acting for the protection of children in the state of Montana.
Hey,
and
Derek,
I think that would be a just outcome.
It's tough to get wins in what you do. And so I'm encouraged, and I want you to be encouraged as well.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
Keep it up. It's important. And we look forward to chatting with you down the road. If you guys want to help out, it's montanafamily.org. Good luck, Derek.
Thank you.
New in Montana here, this safe haven baby box. We have our first one now set up at the Lockwood Fire Department. And what is it? And what is this movement? And who's behind it? We're talking about protecting children with Derek A. Stryker, the Montana Family Foundation. And they're doing it in one way. And Monica Kelsey, who joins us now with Safe Haven Baby Box, is doing it in another way. And Monica, you know, there's a story to tell here, and I really appreciate that. Giving more options, I guess, is how you refer to it, for mothers to turn over their children if they just recognize that they can't take care of them. Good morning, ma'am. Thank you for doing this, by the way. I'm very excited to talk to you about all this process. Why don't you start with your trip to Montana recently? And I saw the video. You gave a nice speech there. I very much appreciated that too. It's new on me, this whole Safe Haven baby box.
Well, you know, the Safe Haven law has actually been around for the last, sorry about that, for the last, 25 years. So Montana's always had the Safe Haven law. They've just not had an anonymous way to surrender an infant.
Yeah.
Before I, started installing boxes, they had to walk into facilities and hand their child to a person. And so what we were finding was babies left at the doors of Safe Haven locations on the ground because a fire station is not manned 24 hours a day. They're staffed 24 hours a day. But if they're out on a fire and a woman walks up to their fire station and wants to surrender and they're not there, what is she supposed to do? Go to the next fire station, which is probably on the same call that the other fire station's on? And so I came up with a way for these parents to still surrender their children but do it, anonymously. And we're in 23 states now. We just launched in Lockwood, at Lockwood Fire Department in Billings, Montana. We do have another box going in Montana probably later this year. And so this is a movement that's crossing this country, and babies are being saved every month because of the anonymity piece, which is so important to some people. You know, walking into a facility and handing a child to a person, basically this parent is saying, I want what's best for my child and it's not me. And sometimes they feel a little shamed and judged if they have to go face to face with someone. They can still do that. We're not taking that option away from them. But we're saying if you can't do that and the option that you're going to choose is a dumpster or a trash can, which happens every 3 days in America, we want you to choose something else. And so we come up with this box, and now women are utilizing it. These babies' lives are being saved simply because of an electronically monitored baby box at fire stations in 350 locations across America.
You know, and that was a fascinating statistic. Every 3 days, a child is surrendered, but not safely in that regard. So talk about how this works. Does an alarm go off? Do they have... Can they leave their name? I mean, do you see these mothers when they maybe get straightened out again, coming back, looking for their child? I mean, you're talking about deep human emotions here, too.
Well, back in 1973, there was no Safe Haven law, and I was abandoned 2 hours after I was born, And so I am that statistic. I am one of those kids that was not safely surrendered. And I'll tell you, having a safe option for parents is critical, if I would have been placed in a dumpster and died, the trauma of, my birth mother would have been a lot more. And so having a safe option for these moms now is critical. But, my statistic that I was just telling you, I just want to correct you on this. It's not safely surrendered every 3 days.
Thank you.
These babies are dumped like in trash cans, in dumpsters every 3 days. These are not safe surrenders. A safe surrender is when a parent walks into a facility and hands a child to a person or places in one of our Safe Haven baby boxes. And the box is actually called 911 on their own. The parent doesn't have to do anything.
Oh.
All they have to do is open the door, place their infant inside, and it's a medical bassinet. It's a controlled environment. It's heated, and they shut the door. The door actually locks, so this baby is secure inside this baby box for average time is 2 minutes. Now, that's really important to understand because before, when babies were being placed in dumpsters and trash cans or outside Safe Haven locations, they were out in the elements for hours. And so now we've got this down to 2 minutes if these parents don't want their faces seen. And so it's a program that, is it ideal? Of course not. Nobody wants to put a baby in a box. But if a parent is going to choose a dumpster, this is a better alternative.
Yeah. Have you encountered some pushback from that? Because, intuitively, it doesn't necessarily sound like it. But when you look at the limited options for people who are afraid just for a lot of reasons. What kind of pushback do you get or how do you overcome that?
Oh, we get a lot of pushback.
I bet.
We get an absolute lot of pushback, and I understand that this is not an ideal situation, but we're not going to sit back and do nothing when we can do something. You know, the safe haven law has been around for 25 years, and even in the state of Montana, we've had a law for 25 years. Why are still babies being dumped in our country then? If there has been a way for a parent to walk into a facility and just wash their hands of an infant and turn around and walk away, why in America is abandonment still happening so often? And it's because of the anonymity piece. It's these women want to walk in, but not face anyone. They want to go to a safe place, but they don't want somebody standing there talking to them. We had one mom that actually placed in our box that she says the reason why she chose the box is because she didn't want to be talked out of a decision that took her so long to make. And that's exactly what firefighters do. You know, I'm a retired firefighter and medic, and we are fixers. We are helpers. And so a woman walking in and handing me a child right now, I would want to try and help. And they don't want that. They've made this decision. This isn't an easy decision for them to make. And they do a lot of research on their smartphones. They know what they're doing. And so for us, we look at it a little bit differently. You know, there's two options. You know, when a woman wants to surrender, she can walk into the facility still at Lockwood Fire Department, or now she can place that baby in one of the boxes at Lockwood Fire Department. And so we're not taking any options away. We're just adding another option to ensure that no baby's left in a dumpster or trash can again.
Monica Kelly, Kelsey is with us here with the Safe Haven Baby Box. And it's simple to go find out more about it. A lot of explanation there too on how it works and how you can be involved in that. SHBB, safehavenbabybox.org for more information. You talked about being a firefighter and a medic, also a U.S. Navy veteran. I want to thank you for that. But also you've got personal story here that, you know, when I mentioned how deeply emotional this has to be, and it's not something that it's an emotion that you can, you know, goes away after 5 days. Share that with us. Share and how important that has been to you when you tell your story and then you know, tell us maybe what kind of emotions you were going through as much as you're able.
Yeah, well, you know, I was adopted. You know, I didn't know a whole lot about my beginnings until I kind of stumbled upon my biological mother when I was 37 years old, and that became the best and the worst day of my life because I had no idea. I mean, I was raised by two amazing parents that I told me that I was adopted, but what they told me was that my parents were young and loved and couldn't care for me, so they placed me for adoption. And that was the farthest thing from the truth when I finally found my biological mother. And this was back in 1972. She was brutally attacked and raped and left along the side of the road. And, you know, back then, the family was looked at differently if a young girl in school was pregnant. And so she was taken out of high school. She was hidden for the entire pregnancy. And then she gave birth and abandoned me 2 hours after I was born. And so, you know, I stand on the front lines of this movement as one of these kids that wasn't lovingly and safely and legally placed in, you know, a safe place or a safe haven baby box. But, you know, this is my legacy, and I'm now their voice. I will forever walk with these moms as they choose something safe, because we deal with every state in America with abandonments, and all of these babies that are being left in unsafe places, there is options available. We just have to get them to these options and let them choose what's best for them. And the states that we're in now, the abandonment rates have dropped. We're actually teetering right now on every 3 to 4 days. A baby is found abandoned in a dumpster or trash can in this country, because the states that have the boxes are not having abandonments anymore, and we're having babies being placed in boxes, which has never been done in American history. You know, this is the first time this has been done.
Right.
You know, in Indiana, just give you a little statistic on Indiana. That's where I'm from. And we launched in Indiana in April of 2016. Every year prior to that, we were finding anywhere from 2 to 3 dead babies a year. So not a lot of babies being dumped. But I thought when I started this program, I'll just, you know, save these 2 babies in Indiana and you know, call it a day, you know, every year, mm-hmm. put a few boxes in. Obviously, Christ had a different job and a different you know,
yeah, different
way
plan.
Bigger job.
Yeah.
Yeah. Different plan for me. But since we installed baby boxes in the state of Indiana, we have not had a dead infant from abandonment in the last 9 years. And we've had almost 40 babies in our boxes. And so when you turn the tide on, you know, this program and this movement, allowing these parents to make a choice, we still get women that walk in and hand their child to a person. And that's always what we want them to do if they can. But then we also have babies in boxes because these women don't want to walk in. And so both options are okay. You know, it's just which one does she want to choose to keep her child safe? And so to say it's an emotional journey is an understatement, because this job is a roller coaster of emotions. You know, yesterday I had a podcast. I have a podcast that's called Beyond the Box with Monica Kelsey. And I interviewed one of the birth moms that utilized our baby box. And the emotions from this mom, I mean, she trusts us. We have a lot of relationships with these moms. And this specific mom, I've grown to love her. I didn't know her before. She had surrendered a few years ago, and I just met her in January. She reached out to me. And the one thing that she tells me every day is, I didn't realize how big of a community there was that was going to love me unconditionally than I did after I met you. And it's true. It's because we rally around these moms. It's not just about saving the baby. It's about saving these moms as well. And I hope everybody listens to that podcast, because you'll really get a sense of how and why these parents feel that this is one of the options that they consider.
All right. Say it again. What's the podcast?
It's called Beyond the Box with Monica Kelsey. It's on all of the platforms. You can also go to YouTube and view it. It dropped on Tuesday. Today's Thursday. So it dropped on Tuesday, and it's the most popular podcast we have. And there's probably 10 podcasts that we have out there, but this is by far the one that everybody wants to listen to, because it's so personal, and she's just got this heart that, and she talks about the reason why she did it. She was in a very low place, and she had her mom had just passed away and found out she was pregnant. It was just, her emotions were just all yes. over the place, and she yeah. made this decision, and now she's strong enough to talk about it.
Boy, just a couple of minutes here to finish up with Monica Kelsey, the founder of Safe Haven Baby Box. This is Montana's first Safe Haven Baby Box, recently installed at the Lockwood Fire Department. Monica, again, thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for getting out there on this. One of the things, and I want to point people to it, check out that podcast, Beyond the Box with Monica Kelsey. TikTok, Safe Haven Baby Box, or at Monica Kelsey, and then shbb.org for the website. A lot of information there. When mothers do release their baby, surrender their baby, how do they get care afterwards?
Well, the care is free, and every box has an orange bag that falls to the feet of these moms, and all they have to do is take this orange bag, and there's a ton of resources in it. There's also a hotline that's on the front of all of our boxes, and so if a mother needs our resources before she uses the box or after she uses the box, we are here to help her along the way to make sure that she makes a good choice that she wants to do, because we're not going to tell her what to do. We're going to give her the options and allow her to make that choice, and then offer the help of walking alongside her on her journey. Shbb.org, there's a ton of information there. Also TikTok, it's probably our most popular social media account. Never one to be on TikTok, but here I am, and that's where women are. The women that we are serving, that's where they're at. So that's where we need to be. So
is the adoption process handled with a reputable third party, I presume?
We don't get involved in the adoption process. Actually, the state takes over. Okay. So the state, once a baby is surrendered, the state takes the infant and processes the infant through adoption.
134 boxes in 9 states. You've already talked about the infants that have been saved in Indiana. You've got a second one coming in Montana. Can you tell me where that's at?
Yeah, we actually have 350 boxes in 23 states
you
right
do?
Now.
You do? This yeah. Oh, my gosh, you've been growing like crazy.
Yeah, and so the next one will be in the city of Missoula.
Okay. Wow. Monica, thank you. God bless you for this, too.
Thank you.
There are people going to greet you in heaven, and you're going to know exactly how they
I
got
hope
there.
So. Yeah. That's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Yeah, good. Keep doing it. See you later.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for joining us for the podcast, and join us weekdays live from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. for more Voices of Montana on great radio stations all across our Treasure State.